Well, thank you very much for, can you all hear me? Does this work? Thank you very much for inviting me. I want to thank the University of Toronto, Professor Rubin of the Polish Embassy. And I love being back here. I taught here for a short time in 2013. And if you like my talk, hopefully some of you will be willing to sponsor my application for political asylum, which I might make on Wednesday.
Finally, there is someone with a sense of humor, right?
I come here very mindful that this, Polish Help to Jews in World War II, is a very fraught topic. No one can deny, as we have heard, that Poland provided more righteous among the nations than any other country. And that includes an individual who risked his life to save my mother and aunt, and whom I succeeded in getting Yad Vashem to recognize in 1998. No one should deny the heroism of those who helped Jews at a time when the Germans made this a capital crime. And we know of at least 750 Poles, probably more, who were executed for this very reason. Frankly, I doubt that I would have had the courage to take those risks. So it's really fitting that we come here tonight to recognize Żegota, the Council to Aid Jews, which was founded in late 1942. And the very existence of Żegota underscored the fact that there were Poles who really wanted to extend aid, that there was an organization that bore the imprimatur of the Polish underground state, that Żegota served as a moral beacon, that it reminded Jews that they were not totally isolated. The names of Irena Sendlerova, Jan Karski, Jan Żabiński, Henryk Woliński, Władysław Bartoszewski, some members of Żegota, some not, many, many others should never be forgotten. Nor should we forget, as Steve Paulson and others have reminded us, that often it took many Poles to help one Jew. Żegota is certainly part of the equation. Unfortunately, as we all know, so is Jedwabne. But the great challenge is to remember that the search for truth is not a zero-sum game, that we have to think about Żegota and we have to think about Jedwabne. And we're not playing some game where one cancels out the other or diminishes from the other. Now, you've also heard that this panel is taking place at a rather difficult time, not just in Polish-Jewish relations, or more precisely Polish-Jewish relations in the academy, but in Polish-Polish relations. In my humble opinion, and I've spent a lot of time in Poland the last decade working on the museum, in my humble opinion, the last 25 years have been one of the best periods in Polish history. Democracy, freedom, economic growth, Poland anchored in the European Union, Poland at peace, the end of occupation and domination. But apparently many Poles did not agree. And today we see the strength of rising nationalism, and we see rising skepticism about the EU and many other developments which are not, in my opinion, very positive. Now, one can understand a natural instinct to take refuge in convenient myths, an instinct, in the case of Poland, honed by centuries of trauma and occupation, and nurtured by a certain version of Polishness, a nation that is heroic, that fights for your freedom and ours, a nation that is often oppressed but that never oppresses others, a nation that is betrayed over and over again by internal and external enemies, a nation that has drawn its moral sustenance not just from love of country and language, but from the great religious values of the Roman Catholic Church. I am not saying that these assertions are false, and God forbid, I hope I'm not coming across as patronizing or condescending. Like all national myths, be they American, Israeli, or Canadian, there is a big core of truth here. And the Poles have a history that they could be certainly proud of. But along with legitimate pride comes an obligation to confront one's past in a truthful and objective manner. All peoples and nations have to separate history from myth. They have to find a proper balance between a feel-good, sanitized national memory and the need to ask honest and painful questions about the past, to subject myth and memory to the hard test of objective historical research. Many of our problems in this particular topic stem from the fact that Jews in Poland were widely seen as aliens, not entitled to equal call on the resources and conscience of the Polish state and the Polish people. It is also understandable why many Poles, after 120-odd years of partition, why many Poles dreamed of an ethnic nation state for Poles, not a multinational state where all nationalities would enjoy equal rights de facto as well as de jure. Jews who dreamed of a Jewish state can certainly understand this tension between democracy and ethnic fulfillment. But sovereignty never comes entirely free of charge, and sometimes one must pay more a moral price. Lately, we have heard Polish ministers who should know better make rather bizarre statements about the Kielce Pogrom and about Jedwabne. And we have the unedifying spectacle of the on-again, off-again investigation of Professor Gross, Jan Gross, whose scholarship has been of great value, and who, along with historians associated with the journals Zagłada Żydów, the destruction of the Jews, have rendered indispensable service in helping Poles understand that there is no such thing as Polish history without Jews, and that what happened during the Holocaust, the good and the bad, is as much a part of Polish history as Mickiewicz, the 19th century uprisings, or the heroism of Warsaw in 1944. Last month, I was proud to have joined many other academics in signing an open letter protesting recent irresponsible statements and actions by certain officials of the current Polish government. That letter pointed out that since the fall of communism, Poland has been a shining example of how the pursuit of historical truth could help a society deal with deep historical wounds and perhaps even ameliorate them. And now I quote, "Any attempt to ignore, rationalize, or deny the fact that Jews were murdered on Polish soil, not only by German forces, but also by their Polish neighbors, will not only undermine long-standing and meticulous academic research, but we fear will gravely damage decades of hard work promoting reconciliation between Poles and Jews, and ultimately Poland's well-deserved, I emphasize, well-deserved reputation in the world as a bastion of truth, tolerance, and democracy. I think it's very important to continue the Polish-Jewish dialogue that began decades ago with the Oxford Conference in 1984 and the Brandeis Conference in 1986, the Jerusalem Conference in 1988, that continued with the establishment of the indispensable journal Polim, and more recently with Zaguada Judo, and I see our meeting tonight in that positive context. These conferences and journals have encouraged an unprecedented upsurge of scholarship. Given what happened, not just during the war, but during the entire span of our shared history, I think it's important for all of us to engage in honest, reasoned conversation. It was in that spirit that I worked for 6 years on a major symbol of Polish-Jewish dialogue, the Poland Museum in Warsaw, where I was lead scholar of the interwar gallery. One of the highlights of that interwar gallery was the newspaper wall, which showed dozens of Jewish journals in Yiddish, Hebrew, and Polish. And in the 1930s, it was the Jewish journals in the Polish language that were the fastest growing journals on the Jewish street. It is a sad irony that on the eve of World War II, more Jews spoke Polish as their first language than ever before. 80% of Jewish children were going to Polish schools. And that despite growing anti-Semitism, many Jews felt a deep love of Poland. Not the Poland of the Index or the ONR, not the country that treated them like second-class citizens, but the country that stood for a great culture, for tolerance, and for democracy. If many Poles saw Jews then as aliens, more Jews than ever saw themselves as deeply tied to the country where their ancestors had lived for centuries. A Jewish historian who personified this love of Poland was Emanuel Ringelblum, about whom I have written. He devoted his whole scholarly life to the study of Polish-Jewish relations and to the demolition of myths and prejudices on both sides. He wanted to normalize and to demystify this complicated topic. Before the war, he saw Polish-Jewish relations in shades of gray rather than black and white. And he believed that historians could serve as a bridge between the two peoples and help them see their neighbors as real human beings, rather than, to borrow a term from Professor Joanna Michlik, as a threatening other. And he totally rejected the notion that Poles were born anti-Semites. In 1940, he founded the secret archive of the Warsaw Ghetto, the Oinik Shabbos, to which he recruited about 60 collaborators. Only three survived the war: Ringelblum, his wife and son, and 32 other Jews, as well as two Poles who helped hide them, were shot by the Germans in March 1944. Before 1942, before the dreadful realization that the Germans intended to murder all the Polish Jews, Ringelblum and many other members of the Oinik Shabbos saw not only negative features, but surprisingly many positive features in Polish-Jewish relations. One key member of the Oinik Shabbos, Abraham Lewin, even wrote in June 1942, "I see Polish-Jewish relations in a positive light." This is in June 1942. "I believe that the Polish people have been purified by the terrible fire that has swept the face of the earth. Let us not forget, the Poles are in second place in the table of tragic losses among the nations, just behind the Jews." And in his writings, Ringelblum, too, up to 1942, presented a positive picture. He wrote about how anti-Semitism virtually disappeared in the weeks before the German invasion. And he wrote about the battles of September 1939, where Poles and Jews fought side by side, and that reminded him of the heady days of 1861, of the so-called Spratania, of the Brotherhood, where hopes were high for Polish-Jewish reconciliation. He stressed how in 1940 and 41, then he polls health Jews. He stressed the importance of the massive smuggling, which was a key symbol of Polish-Jewish cooperation and without which Jewish Warsaw would have starved. At the same time, again, not knowing that the Germans intended to kill Polish Jewry and thinking about the post-war period, at the same time, he foresaw delicate questions which would arise after the war, such as the charge that Jews had collaborated en masse with the Soviets in their occupation of Eastern Poland. And to that end, the Oynik Shabbos collected many documents which described all aspects of this very, very sensitive, issue. But in 1942, with the beginning of mass murder, Jewish perceptions of Poles changed markedly for the worse. And this is shown in Ringelblum's writings. This is also shown in the recent work of Professor Harvey Dreyfus of Tel Aviv University. And one of the founders of Żygota, Zofia Kosak-Szczucka, wrote in 1942, "The peasants had an attitude of Christian charity towards the Jews, but when the Germans began to kill them, and the peasants saw that God did not send thunder and lightning to strike the Germans dead, many probably told themselves, perhaps this is ordained by the Lord himself." Ringelblum was caught by the Germans on the fourth day of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising in April 1943, sent to Trawniki labor camp, and with the help of the Polish underground, he made a daring escape and ended up in a bunker in South Warsaw, maintained by a Polish family with financial help from the Jewish underground. He stayed there from August 1943 until March 1944, when the bunker was denounced by a Polish informer to the Gestapo, and that informer was soon executed by the Home Army. In this bunker, by the flickering light of a carbide lamp, Ringelblum wrote in the Polish language his masterpiece, Polish-Jewish Relations in the Second World War. No Xerox machines, no graduate students, no library, but it's a great book, and it still has enormous value. He wrote this book with a crushing sense of responsibility. He believed that he was the last Jewish historian left alive in Poland. Centuries of shared life on the Polish lands were ending in murder, bitterness, and recrimination. He had seen his people die, and he had also seen the best and the worst in the behavior of his Polish neighbors. And now he believed that he had to get it absolutely right. He could make no mistakes. Every word mattered. So in the introduction to this work, Ringelblum, this left-wing Marxist Zionist, compared himself to a cipher, to a Jewish scribe writing a Torah scroll. And the scribe has to take a ritual bath in order to cleanse himself of all impurity. And he knows that he's not allowed even one mistake. And this is what Ringelblum wrote about himself as he set out in that bunker to write about the topic that we're discussing tonight. He emphasized that Poles had twice saved his life, and he rejected the claims of some Jews that all Poles rejoiced in the Jewish disaster. There were hearts on the Aryan side that, I quote, of bleed and suffer for us. But nonetheless, Ringelblum's overall conclusion about the behavior of the Polish underground state and of the Polish Home Army was negative. The Ringelblum essay was a unique synthesis of the immediacy of contemporaneous testimony with the analytic dispassion of retrospective historical analysis. The book reflected the tension between historical objectivity and the shock of the enormous crimes that Ringelblum witnessed not as a bystander, but as a direct victim. Detached historians can make the necessary distinctions between perpetrators and bystanders. They can distinguish between Polish and German anti-Semitism, between active complicity, craven greed, and indifference. For a member of a victimized people to do so required a major effort of intellectual discipline. Ringelblum, writing both as a historian and as a witness, wrote an essay that decades later still retains of scholarly relevance. He went out of his way to emphasize that it was the Germans and not the Poles who were responsible for the Holocaust, and that even if the Poles were more willing to help, that help could not easily counter the German obsession with killing every Jew. He also went out of his way to emphasize how difficult it was for Poles to hide Jews or even help Jews in the face of German terror and the manifold difficulties of everyday life in wartime. He paid ample tribute to Polish patriotism, self-sacrifice, and to Polish bravery. He praised Żegota, but he underscored its lack of sufficient resources and declared that Polish help to Jews was mainly an individual matter rather than a result of a conscious policy encouraged by the underground state. But as I said, the general tenor was quite negative. When the disaster began, Ringelblum charged, the Polish underground, even in the face of the severe difficulties it faced, did not do enough to help Jews, who, as citizens of the Republic, had a moral claim to such help. The sphere of moral responsibility included Poles, but excluded Jews. And the extension of help to Jews was often morally unacceptable in the eyes of Polish neighbors. Why was it, Ringelblum asked, that when Germans were in hot pursuit of a fleeing Pole on the streets of Warsaw, often all they had to do was yell, "Catch the Jew," and someone would come forward to help catch that person? Why was it that the Home Army did not do enough to arm Jews and then turn around and charge the Jews with passivity as an excuse for not helping? And I quote now, I'm about to end. "The Polish people and the government of the Republic of Poland," these are Ringelblum's words, "were incapable of deflecting the Nazi steamroller from its anti-Jewish course. But the question is permissible whether the attitude of the Polish people befitted the enormity of the calamities that befell the country's Jewish citizens. Was it inevitable that Jews, looking their last on this world as they rode on the death train speeding to Treblinka, should have to see indifference or even gladness on the face of their neighbors?" And perhaps the last word is I can leave to Aleksander Kaminski, who headed the Bureau of Information and Propaganda in the underground Polish government, and who said, "Along with evidence of the readiness of many Poles to help, I also saw many cases of moral insanity. There wasn't much we could do to help, but Jews are right when they said we hope too little." To conclude, Ringelblum got many things right, but I'm ready to grant that he also got certain things wrong. Thanks to the research of Josh Zimmerman, Dariusz Lubionka, Dariusz Stola, and many, many others, we now have a much more nuanced view of the Polish government in exile, of the Home Army. We know a lot more about Żegota. Thanks to the work of Jan Grabowski and Jan Gross, we have a much deeper view of the other side of the equation. And we can only remember that Ringelblum left us not a finished product, but he left us a moral commandment to seek historical truth. and to follow that truth in whatever direction it led. And it's up to us to redeem that important legacy. Thank you.